So we are so grateful that you're here. Parker and I were talking about the pastor. I mean, amazing. We learned about angels, and we learned about creation evolution, and we learned about the culture war, and you know where I'm going. And we learned a whole lot about Krispy Kreme, didn't we? I don't know how many of you have a Krispy Kreme app. I did not know that, but you know, you learn so many things, you know, in the Sunday school message. But anyway, I was not there last night, and there's a very good reason for it. I have been in the leadership of the International Society of Christian Apologetics, and we were having our annual conference this year at Southern Evangelical Seminary in Charlotte. It was kind of a who's who. We had the president of Southwestern Baptist Seminary, Paige Patterson. We had the president of Southern Evangelical Seminary, Dr. Richard Land. We had one of the professors from Denver Seminary, Dr. Norman Geisler, who is the founding member of the International Society of Christian Apologetics and author of, I think he said the other day, I wrote 80 books by the age of 80. So I guess he's up to 80 books or something like that. And on and on and on. I go through that long, long list. So that was good just to be with all of those individuals. And for my own personal benefit, it was good because they were actually able to elect someone else to leadership. So this will be the first time in years and years where I've not been in the leadership of the International Society of Christian Apologetics. And so I don't know what I'm going to do with all my free time now as president of Probe and a host of Point of View and teaching here in the class, but you know, nevertheless, it has been a little bit of a burden, but it's been a very good one. So that's where I was. And again, it was just exciting not only to be with some of those people, but to meet some of the rising stars and individuals that we'll quote from. So we're going to spend some time today in John chapter 19. How many of you are cold? When I walked in here very first, it was really cold, and our body heats warmed it up a little bit. But, you know, after you sit here for a while, I think everybody's going to get cold. So I might end a little earlier than normal, especially since some of you have short-sleeved shirts on here and blouses. We might try to see what we can do to endure this. But we're going to spend some time today looking at certainly the crucifixion. And then also, as always, if you're new to the class, and I've just met a few of you that have been here once or twice, we always do some application, and I've pulled something from a very interesting article that was in Christianity Today. But we see as we turn to chapter 19, and we'll start in verses 16 and 17 there, looking at, of course, Jesus taken to be crucified. And in this passage, we see that John reports on those events. And it's easy for us, because of these events, to say, well, I kind of know how it all turns out. Spoiler alert, he doesn't stay in the tomb. You know, but think about this if you were reading this for the first time. These messages were not originally in a Bible. They were in scrolls. We were just hearing about this. There would be a public reading of the Gospel of John. And imagine if you've heard about this person, Jesus. I would encourage you to watch the TV series right now, AD. Last week we saw some of that. Tonight we'll see Jesus coming out of the grave. And you get a little bit of a sense of how they're getting, for the first time, a story of the followers of the Nazarene. You know, before they were even known as Christians. And they're reading the scroll, and here they've been hearing the story of this miracle worker, this man who claimed to be God, and now they are seeing unfolded before their very eyes and in their mind's eye someone who is crucified in such a horrific way. And you, of course, know the rest of the story, but they, of course, do not. And just imagine this. But John's goal here is not to tell the history, because by the time he's written his gospel, Matthew, Mark, and Luke had existed, and those various documents were already circulating around. His goal here is to make sure that we know that the events of this passage occur in order to fulfill Scripture. And as he has been doing, he picks and chooses some of the stories. He doesn't give us the whole story. If you want to learn more about the seven words of Jesus on the cross, which we'll talk about in just a minute, you go to Luke 23. You get much more of that there. He only picks out two of those. But he does this in large part for us to really see the scriptural and prophetic significance of all of that. And so we're going to start with certainly the what I call the cruel crucifixion. We see this in verses 17 and following. They took Jesus and went out bearing his own cross to the place called the Place of the Skull, which in Aramaic is Golgotha. There they crucified him, with him two others, one on either side, and Jesus between them. Pilate also wrote an inscription and put on the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. So the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but rather this man said, I am King of the Jews. But Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. And we'll continue on, but we can begin to see, we already see some of the prophetic significance of all of this. And throughout this, he's really trying to show, first of all, that it's more than just the historic events that are happening, but it's a fulfillment of Scripture. And we see, first of all, that he was crucified between two thieves. Now, I thought about showing the video, but I thought it might just be so gruesome. We've seen it so many times before. But if you look at some of the videos out there right now, some of them don't have Jesus crucified between the two thieves. Well, that's what John records. And even today when I was in church, there was a little boy sitting in front of me. And at one point, he was drawing a picture, and I saw when he held it up to his mother. And he had Jesus between the two thieves. And then had the I thought, the little boy got it better than Hollywood got it, you know, because there you are. He actually had it all right. And his mother was very proud of him. And I thought, you know, I don't even know that he's in the third grade. And he's got it all together. He needs to go to Hollywood and explain that to some of the producers. You know, then the garments are divided, and why he's given sour wine. All of this is really to be seen in the sense of a fulfillment of prophecy, which is so very powerful, because again, we see these prophecies written down before the time of Christ, probably 60 different categories of messianic prophecies, almost 300 different references to them in the Old Testament, all literally fulfilled now. And as we'll see in just a minute, in this 24-hour period, 24 of those prophecies are all fulfilled. So this is what John is really trying to emphasize here. And because of this, there are things that you have in the Gospel of John that you have nowhere else. For example, he takes some of the points that the other gospel writers omitted and puts them in there. The division of the clothes, for example, which we see. The casting of the lots for his tunic. The offering of wine, the breaking of the legs of the thieves, and the piercing of his side are all found in the Gospel of John. So if you really want to understand this event, you have to put those together. But here, very significantly, we see that. And most importantly, this idea of being placed between two thieves was significant to John. And he sees that because he sees it a fulfillment of one of the prophecies that is in the book of Isaiah. By the way, for those of you that are relatively new to the class, you got to come on all the tours with us. And one of the tours we took was to Southwestern Baptist Seminary, and we got to see a fragment of this particular Dead Sea Scroll of Isaiah 53. And in that fragment, in verse 12, it says that the Messiah will be numbered with the transgressors, for he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. And here, John, as well as Matthew, say that this is a fulfillment of that messianic prophecy in the book of Isaiah. I would dare say that even as Isaiah is writing this down, and God is telling him to write it down, he does not understand the significance, but now we see the significance of being crucified between two thieves in a horrific way that it actually takes place. To understand the crucifixion, we have to read into some of the literature. And from time to time, I've quoted from Josephus, who was the Jewish historian, or Tacitus, who is the Roman historian. But we know quite a bit about how crucifixion took place. And that is, if this was typical, and there's no reason to believe it was not, an individual, in this case Jesus, was placed in the center of what was known as a quaternion. And that was a company of four Roman soldiers. And they would actually then actually put a crossbeam on him. Sometimes they would actually put a cross. And so some movies show a cross, some show a crossbeam. Many people think that it was that. But in either case, the best estimates are it may have weighed 100 pounds. You ever carried a 100-pound piece of lumber on your shoulder? I've worked as a ditch digger, and I've done a few other things, and have helped put shingles on roof of house, which I do not recommend on the Texas heat, and I've done that a few times. You know, just carrying up some of those shingles up a ladder, really difficult, and especially after you've been whipped, as we've already talked about. But then, this is the part that, again, most of the movies get accurate, because you have those four soldiers. They are leading him through, actually, a very long route. As you can see in my last point here, they would take the longest route possible because the idea was to show everybody, as the Roman soldier was carrying the placard of his crime, to basically show that crime does not pay. There's some debate as to whether or not Jesus really walked down the Via Doloroso, but any time you go to Israel, as I have done, we walked the Via Doloroso. And you can realize, if indeed that is the route, it was a pretty long route. And it was intended to be so. It was intended to show everybody what would happen if you ever dared cross the Roman Empire. And so here is the procession as they're bringing him along, a man holding a placard, which I believe is the one that they actually put over him, which had it in three different languages saying he is King of the Jews. And this was, quote, his crime. We'll get to what Pilate said in just a minute, but that is the procession that he is carrying his cross. We learn, of course, from other gospel accounts that at this point Jesus is so weak he cannot carry his cross. So we have a man who is from Cyrene, which is present-day Libya, to actually carry the cross, interestingly enough, up to Golgotha. At the time of the execution, then I think most of us understand that he's laid on what's called a patibulum, and then spikes are driven into his wrists and crossbar. Again, this is where some of the movies get it wrong, because they put it through his hands, because they say, well, it said they drew it through his hands, but in the Greek, a hand was considered the wrist and the hand, and so they weren't necessarily, and frankly, we know, because we have actually now archaeologically found individuals who were crucified where they were not able to pull the spikes out and they buried them, and so we actually have seen those. I was going to put those up there, but he gross as well, but we know, indeed, they drove them through the wrist. It was through the hand. Eventually the hand would slip off. It would just rip off the flesh. And so it is driven there, and then they lift them up on the crossbar. Of course, some have him on the cross pulling it up. And in either case, then they nailed the legs together with just enough flex so that they could push themselves up to take a breath. Most of the people that died in crucifixion died from asphyxiation because they just simply lacked the ability to push themselves up to take a breath. Or, as we will see in a minute, they broke the legs of the two thieves so they could no longer push themselves up. And so this is just a horrific amount of pain. For those of you who would ever want to read about this, and it's not something we want to read about before lunch, but there was a very good article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, of all things, in the 1980s, I think it was in 1986, was done by pathologists, and it talks about the pain and death of Jesus, just from a pathological point of view. Couldn't have been a more excruciating way to execute an individual. Only implemented in the Roman Empire in 65 BC, where they had borrowed it from some of the barbarians. That's going to be important in just a minute when we look at some of those prophecies. And so this was the execution. We've all seen, you know, Passion of the Christ or Jesus of Nazareth, so we won't spend a lot more time on the crucifixion other than to establish that it happened. I want to switch there then now to look at Pilate, because as I just read a minute ago, Pilate actually posted King of the Jews and put this in three languages so that anybody walking by, knowing any one of these languages, and many would know all three quite likely, but some would know one or the other or two of the three, they would know exactly what that was. Now, some people have speculated, why did he put that up there? And some speculation has been that he was maybe trying to mock Jesus. But as we said last time, you know, he was really pretty much attempting to prevent the execution of Jesus. So it's possible he'd already sort of mocked him already with the scourging. So many people believe, and I think the most reasonable assumption is this was a way of mocking the Jewish authorities who were forcing him to kill who he believed was an innocent man. And if you understand the placard, it was long before it was posted up there. The placard was being held by what? The Roman soldier as they're walking down the Via Dolorosa. So everybody is seeing this man described as the King of the Jews, and he was, in a sense, mocking those who had just as crowds been calling for his death. So I think that's the reasonable explanation for what goes there. But more importantly now, we see also in verse 23 and following that they crucified him, took his garments, divided them into four parts, one part for each person, but also the tunic, because it was seamless then that they decided to cast lots. And here's where we see 24 of those 60 categories of messianic prophecies all fulfilled within about a 24-hour period. You know, we saw those before from Zechariah, that he would be betrayed by a friend for 30 pieces of silver, which, by the way, when that prophecy was, the means of exchange was gold, that it would be cast down and used to buy a potter's field. Right there in Zechariah, you have a number of those prophecies all fulfilled. Now we see some other prophecies being fulfilled, and probably the best psalm, messianic psalm to look at that would be Psalm 22. How does Psalm 22 begin? My God, why hast thou forsaken me? That is how the psalm begins. In a minute, we're going to see that's what Jesus says, and there's a sense in which I think he's saying from the cross, that psalm applies to me. But let me just take one set of verses to show you how those all were literally fulfilled in his crucifixion. The first is, dogs have surrounded me. That is a Jewish term for Gentile. So you have Gentiles surrounding him. At the time when this prophecy was given, a Jew that was killed would be killed not by Gentiles. A Jew would be killed by what? Jews, for blasphemy. By what? Stoning, not crucifixion. Interesting. A band of evildoers has encircled me. They have pierced my hands and feet. When this prophecy was given, what was the mode of execution? I just said it. Stoning. Wasn't until about 65 BC that the Roman Empire instituted crucifixion. I can count all my bones. That's a Jewish idiom for I'm naked. Hate to say it, and I understand why they do it, but everybody that was crucified on a cross was stripped naked. You know, they always have some kind of covering there. I understand it's television, movies, and all the rest. But the idea is I can look down. The goal here was to totally humiliate an individual. So here, I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Do you see how all of those elements in Psalm 22 were literally fulfilled in what? The crucifixion of Jesus. There are people that sometimes say, you know, well, Jesus just got lucky, you know. He saw some of the prophecies fulfilled and so just tried to constrain the rest of them so that they would all fulfill. How much control does Jesus have over any of this sitting on the cross? I think, again, just a powerful argument. This weekend when we were at the conference, at one point somebody was going through incredible detail in one of these things. At the end, somebody stood up and said, you know, I really agree with Norm Geisler's book. It's got a title, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, you know, and everybody started laughing because that's the point. You know, to believe all of this happened by coincidence or chance, I think it takes more faith than to believe that it was, again, part of God's divine fulfillment. Finally, we come here to the last words, and these are significant because we see in verses 25 and following, but standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother and disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from this hour, the disciple took her home. And so we can see here now in the last words, "Behold your son, behold your mother." He does this most likely because Joseph most likely was not alive. And so none of his half-brothers were part of his mission and ministry. So he then says, John, most likely, is who this was, to be caring for his mother. And it's, again, a fulfillment of the Ten Commandments. And if nothing else, an illustration of his care even from the cross. And this kind of brings us to what are called the seven last words of Jesus. I don't know if you want to write these down, but these are the ones that are used so often. And there, as a matter of fact, you're going to see in just a minute, I'm going to quote from a very good book that I would highly recommend for those of you that might like to read a short book, which is deceptive because Stu Epperson said he spent probably 5 years writing this book. What he did was read all the books that he could find and all the articles ever written on the last words of Jesus and try to pull together what he thought were the best and then put it in a short book. And I think it's really well done. I'm going to quote from it in just a minute. But we have many of these from Luke 23. Father, forgive them. You will be with me in paradise. Behold your son, we just see right here now, which was really the third thing he said from the cross. Then in Mark, why have you forsaken me? We also see that in other Gospels. And then we see these here, as we'll see in just a minute, in John 19. I am thirsty, it is finished, and Father, I commit my spirit. And these are sort of the seven words of Jesus. There have been great sermons, sermon series on it. But let me recommend this book. I interviewed Stu Epperson recently, and yes, I guess I'll have to go get some CDs of that interview and bring them next week. But Stu Epperson is the son of the man who founded Salem Radio Network. If you're familiar with Christian radio, Ed Axinger and Stu Epperson are the two founders of Salem Radio Network. And if you lived anywhere but in the Dallas area, you would know Salem. But even in Dallas, Salem owns K-Word and KLTY. You ever heard of those radio stations? Okay, so you get that sense. Stu Epperson's a fellow talk show host actually in North Carolina. And he has, I think, done a very good job. And next to these, you might want to put some key words, because he has a great alliteration that works with it. And the first of those is, Father, forgive them. That's really a word of prayer. And he spends a little bit of time in this book talking about, you know, not only that he forgave everyone, because again, forgive them, who are them? Well, it's all of us, not just those who crucified him, but also the need for us to be willing to forgive others. And even talks about how forgiveness is really the best thing you can possibly do for your own physical and mental health. For those of you that every once in a while like to listen to Robert Jeffers, he's been doing a whole series at First Baptist on forgiveness. And the fact that he could do week upon week upon week on forgiveness illustrates the importance of that. So first of all, that's a word of prayer. The second one, you will be with me in paradise, that would be called a word of pardon. A word of pardon. Because here now we see that there are those who ask for forgiveness. Stu Epperson on a radio program asked, okay, how many people on the cross ask for forgiveness? How many ask for salvation? And the natural reaction is one. He says, no, actually two. Think about this. The first one, even though he said it in a derogatory way, said, if you are the Christ, save yourself and us. So really, in a sense, you had both thieves ask. Of course, the other one, Lord, please remember when you come into your kingdom. But both thieves asked for it, but one did it out of a unrepentant heart, with sort of a derogatory comment. And the other did it with a repentant heart, with a desire for salvation. And what's his answer to you, that individual? Today you will be with me in what? Paradise. So again, you can see, first of all, a word of prayer, a word of pardon. The third one is, behold your son. You could call that a word of paternity. A word of paternity. And that is a care for his son, for his, if you will, brother in Christ, and for his mother, and for all the things that we should do in terms of caring for the widows, the orphans, the poor, caring for our family, honoring our father and mother. This week I had Dennis Prager on, and we spent a fair amount of time talking about one of the Ten Commandments, about how if you get honor your father and mother correct, and if the family is strong, the culture and the government and the country will be strong. But if you violate that commandment and the family falls apart, the culture, the society, and the nation fall apart. And so you see that even there in this one. The fourth one, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? This would be what you would call a word of pain. This is the first time, if you will, that the Godhead, the Trinity, the Son, the Father, and the Spirit were actually emotionally and spiritually separated from one another. And of course, this is the opening words in Psalm 22 in terms of the fulfillment there. But also it brings us into just the complete darkness of that day, which some of the videos get right and others simply ignore. I mean, it becomes dark at this point. I mean, it's almost like God covers over the incredible shame and humiliation his son is going through. And then we come on to the last few. Number five, I thirst. This would be a word of passion, another P. And here, it's not just I thirst, but just the excruciating pain of being on the cross, the raging thirst, the inability to breathe, the passion of the Christ itself. Certainly we see there as well. The last two we see in number six, it is finished. This would be a word of perfection. If you're looking for another P, a word of perfection. And now, finally, all of it, to telestai. The debt is paid. There is no longer any kind of debt that we owe because of what Christ did on the cross. And then finally, and again, I apologize to Stu Effort for going through a book with so many insights to go through it so quickly. The last one, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit, a word of peace. The last P, a word of peace. And here again, we see in gravestones, rest in peace. And so many times we say rest in peace to individuals, but we're not so sure some of them are going to rest in peace in eternity. And this is a reminder that he has committed his life and actually helped us to survive. This is a book published by Worthy. It is a very small book. I'm going to make sure if they don't have it in the Prestonwood Library to get it. If you wanted to read a fairly small book with just lots of gems in it, that is the book by Stu Epperson that I'd recommend. And there it is on the screen in case later on you can't remember it. As Parker points out, we always keep it on the screen, so I'll keep that up there. We can even have a link to it if you want a little bit later on PrestonwoodExamined.org. Well, I've taken a little too long on the crucifixion. Let's deal with a few other issues here, and that is now what I'll call not only the crucifixion, but now his dramatic death, starting in verse 28. Here we see the body is collected, laid in the tomb. The rest of this passage is really dedicated to the body of Jesus and the actions taken by the groups. I might just, for those of you that are looking at messianic prophecies, these are always so useful if you're witnessing to a Jewish individual. Here, the I am thirsty, many people believe that actually relates back to Psalm 69, verse 21, where Jesus says, I thirst. And of course, then it is finished refers not only to the end of his suffering, but most importantly, the completion of his salvation for the entire human race. On my way back to the airport, I noticed, there's the Billy Graham Library. I don't have to get on a plane just yet. So I pulled over and went to the Billy Graham Library. And here, it was striking because as you go through the Billy Graham Library, the two largest things in the library are these huge crosses. And when I had Greg Laurie on the radio recently, he at one point asked Dr. Graham, you know, you have been an evangelist. Now I'm doing proclamation evangelism. I'm doing crusade evangelism. Anything you would pass on to me, anything you wish you had done differently, you regretted you would do, maybe you could do differently if you could do your life over again. And without a hesitation, Dr. Graham turned to Greg Laurie and said, I would focus more on the cross. And when you're at that library, there's one cross that's almost as big as this room. And then there's a place where you can actually commit your life to the Lord, which I love. I wonder how many people come to know the Lord in the Billy Graham Library. But then you walk through a series of well-lit LED crosses as well. And it's just a reminder again of the finished work of Christ. And what a great opportunity for us to, again, recognize that it is finished. Let's go on real quickly then, and again, I've already mentioned this in verses 31 and 33. They hastened death by breaking the legs of those so they could no longer breathe. But, interestingly enough, here John reminds us in the passage here as well, and we see this also in the book of Matthew, that no bone was to be broken of a sacrificial lamb. And so some people see that as significance as well. But again, in order to make sure that Jesus is dead, they thrust a spear into him or slice him at this point, and it comes out with blood and water separated. There's no blood pulsing. At this point, rigor mortis is even setting in. And so they were very good at knowing when somebody was dead. And they bring him down, of course, remove the spikes. And now we begin to see this as well. And again, he identifies himself as an eyewitness to the death of Jesus. Recognize this is the fourth of the Gospels to be written. By this time, some of the disciples had been martyred already. It was good for him, he felt, to say that I was there at the cross, I saw him die, and I saw him rose from the dead, from the grave. And so again, very important as well. He says he knows that he is telling the truth. Once again, he's reminding us why he wrote this gospel, because he was the eyewitness of all these events that are now being described. And of course, then we talk about the fact that his bones were not broken. That's a fulfillment of Psalm 34, another messianic psalm. It's like almost every few minutes, another psalm or another messianic prophecy is being fulfilled in the life of Christ. And then, of course, and they look on him who they have pierced, another statement about being pierced in Zechariah. Finally, the beloved burial. And we finish off here with verses 38 and following. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, who was the disciple of Jesus, but secretly for the fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus. And Pilate gave him permission so that he came and took away his body. Nicodemus also, who earlier had come to Jesus by night, came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds in its weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen cloths with the spices, as is the burial custom of Jews. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had been laid. So because of the Jewish day of preparation, since the day tomb was closed at hand, they laid Jesus there. And we now see a number of things. First of all, we see Joseph of Arimathea, who here John describes as probably a secret believer, but then he is the only one to add that Nicodemus came there as well. The other gospel writers did not, implying perhaps that Nicodemus was also a secret disciple. Think of the contrast. Where are the disciples at this point? With exception maybe of John. And so who steps up but two secret believers? And they wrap Jesus in more than 70 pounds of spices within the sheets, and all of that is taking place there. And then he finishes really with just kind of a quick story. And that is that this is what has happened. I was the eyewitness. I saw Jesus die on the cross. I saw the Roman soldiers confirm that he was dead by pushing a spear into his side. I was there when the body was taken down and wrapped in spices. And I saw when the body was placed in a new tomb where there was a garden. But rather than that being the end of the story, spoiler alert, he comes out of the grave. But imagine again, if you are a first century believer, or maybe just an interested seeker, and you've heard about these people that are the followers of the Nazarene, at this point, you have to be in the midst of horror. You have to be shocked. You have to be dismayed that this great miracle worker, this person who claimed to be God, is crucified and laid in a tomb. But of course, the good news is, as we'll find out next week in more detail, he rose from the dead. Just before we run out of time here, though, I wanted to spend a little bit of time taking on some of the possible errors from Easter. And I'm going to take these from an article that appeared in Christianity Today. 5 errors to drop from your Easter sermon. This was actually an article written to pastors, and it came out about 2 weeks ago. Things you don't want to say in your Easter sermon. And I thought it'd be kind of fun. I'm going to take 5 of them real quickly, because if nothing else, it helps give us a little more context to what is happening here, and also maybe helps us from making the same mistakes that these two seminary professors were warning pastors not to say from the pulpit of their messages. Are you ready? Here's the first one. The first one is that Jesus died at the age of 33. It's interesting because what they say is don't say that Jesus died at the age of 33, because it comes from a common mistake. People say, well, when was Jesus born? Well, he was born in 1 AD, or some people say 0 AD, whatever, 1 BC. No, he wasn't. We'll find that out in just a minute. And of course, when you go to the Gospel of Luke, it says that he began his ministry when he was about 30 years of age. So they say, okay, he started about 30 years of age. If you look at the Gospel of John, we have 3 Passovers, so it looks like the earthly ministry of Jesus was 3 years, although there could be a 4th Passover there if you compare the 4 Gospels. But 3 to 3.5 years, and so if he's born in 1 AD, he's 33 years of age, right? Well, there's a problem with that. And we've talked about this before when we've done some of the chronologies of Jesus. By the way, if you're really interested in the chronology of Jesus, without a doubt, the best book ever written on the subject is a book by Harold Honer. Used to be a professor at Dallas Seminary. He did his doctoral dissertation at Cambridge on this and took it and put it in a simple book called The Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ. And Harold Honer and others have pointed out something very obvious, and that is, why do we have this 1 AD, 1 BC? Well, because individuals did not have access to all the manuscripts when they established the, Western calendar, they got the date wrong. There is a real good reason to recognize why Jesus was not born in 1 AD, and that is, he was born when Herod ordered the killing of the infants. Remember this? Well, we know from secular history, we know from Jewish history, we know from Roman history, we know from all historical accounts that Herod the Great actually died in the spring, almost in March. It could even have been on the first day of spring, like March 21st of 4 B.C., Okay, it doesn't take long to figure out that Jesus had to be born before 4 B.C., right? He actually said to kill all the male children in Bethlehem and all that region who were 2 years old. So it's possible that Jesus could have been born earlier. Harold Honer makes a very good case for the fact that, you know, the historical date for Jesus, December 25th, could be actually true. And so he suggests that he could have been born on December 25th, 5 B.C. Others say, no, it had to be in the spring or it could have been the year before. But nevertheless, if it's 5 or 6 B.C., then that would mean Jesus had to be about 37 years of age when he died in A.D. 33. We know that date very well because if you've been here before and we've talked about both in history and here's where astronomy helps us in astronomy, we can really document that Jesus was born on April 3rd, 33 A.D. We can do that for a number of different reasons, and if you're interested, you can go back to look at some of our old exam and class messages, because we go into work done by Colin Humphrey and others that have. As a matter of fact, this week I had John Lennox on. He is a professor at Oxford University. He's the one guy that debates Richard Dawkins and has done so well that Richard Dawkins will never debate him again. And anyway, John Lennox was talking about the work by Colin Humphreys and others where they were looking at the blood moons and all the other astronomical signs, and they can document with perfect accuracy that Jesus was crucified on April 3rd, 33 AD. So we know when he died. We have a pretty good idea when he was born. Pretty much sure he was 37 years of age. That one's pretty simple, but let's take another one that comes up all the time, and that is lots of times people will, and pastors will say, you know, there was no lamb at the supper because Jesus was the Passover lamb. And while it is true that Jesus is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, that's John 1:29, this doesn't mean that there wasn't lamb at the Lord's Supper. There certainly was a Paschal lamb, and the reason for that is we have in the Gospel of John the fact that this took place on the day of unleavened bread. That was the day in which the lambs were sacrificed. And if last week you watched A.D., the television movie at 8 o'clock, need to watch it tonight, you will see one point there where they're actually showing them washing all the blood from all the lambs that were killed. And so that happened on that day. So there is certainty that there was a lamb at the Passover meal. It was required to go back to Exodus 12, and that again illustrates that as well. That's why they ate the meal together as a group on that night, the day of unleavened bread, within the city gates. We know all of that indeed. They would have probably done this while eating the lamb, the bread, the herbs, and drinking red wine. Sorry, Baptists, yes, they did have wine at the Last Supper. We don't have it at ours, but they did have that there. And this was, why was Jesus doing this? Because he was teaching that just as the sacrificial lamb provided protection from the angel of death, so now he would be the Lamb of God who would protect them from judgment, which we heard about today from Pastor Graham. So that's the second one. Okay, the third error, and this one I've heard so many times that I hadn't really thought about it till I read this. You always hear that these crowds welcomed him on what? Palm Sunday. Matter of fact, we actually know when Palm Sunday was as well, because that's a fulfillment of the prophecy of the 69 weeks of Daniel. Because we have from the decree of Artaxerxes to the time in which you should look for a Messiah, it's 69 sevens of years. If you work out the numbers, 173,880 days. And that day is what? Palm Sunday. What's happening on Palm Sunday? People are welcoming him as the Messiah. A few days later, they're shouting, kill him. And so lots of times pastors will say, well, these are the same crowds, and it just shows the fickleness of people. Probably not true. The former group is most likely were those individuals who were at the gate, and who were they? They were the pilgrims. These were the people that came down from Galilee with him. They are the ones that had seen all the miracles. They know most likely were, if not professed disciples, certainly were followers of Jesus. So the people that welcome him into the gate are most likely all of the pilgrims who were followers of Jesus. The latter group are those who got up early on that morning with the Jewish leaders, roused up by the leaders, and were those whose lives were actually being affected. Remember a couple of weeks ago we talked about who did Jesus appear to before anyone else? Annas. Annas was the father of Caiaphas. Annas had all of the tables that were in the temple. And who turned over all the temples and was bad for business? Okay? So these are probably are two very different groups. It makes for a great message about how fickle we are. One minute we worship Jesus, the next minute we reject him. But these are probably two different groups. They were probably both, interestingly enough, motivated by an incorrect view of who the Messiah was. The former group, they were welcoming him because they saw him as what? The Messiah King. They said, Hosanna in the highest. They wanted him to come and take over the throne. They wanted him to kick out the Jews that were in leadership. Certainly wanted him to kick out all of the Romans and wanted to establish his messianic kingdom right there. But they had the wrong view there. Well, the ones that actually were stirred up by the leadership, they had the wrong view too because they saw the Messiah claiming to be God and they accused him of what? Blasphemy, claiming to be God when you're not. And so they had a false view as well. But I think these are two very different groups. And so again, just another suggestion to pastors, maybe something to avoid in your sermon. The fourth one I thought was really good, and that is the role of women. You know, we've already talked about all these Marys here. I know we have Marys in the room as well. I see one Mary right back there. You have Mary Magdalene. Why was she called that? Well, there was the town Magdala. That's where she's from, which is a little small town near the Sea of Galilee. Then, of course, have Mary, the mother of Jesus. Then you have Mary, the mother of James and John. And then you have Mary, which we just saw there, Mary, the wife of Clopas. And then, of course, you also have Johanna and Salome. And so really, in a sense, one of the things they were saying is don't ignore the testimony of the women. And I think the testimony of the women teaches two very important principles. First of all, it shows how radically Jesus turned the world on its head. Because Jesus radically affirmed women. This week as I was reading about this, I was struck by the fact that Josephus at one point, and he was the Jewish historian, said, you cannot even trust the testimony of four women in a Jewish court because they can be easily misled. And I thought about this. At that time, the Jews had an even lower view of women than Muslims do. Because in the Quran, it teaches that a woman's testimony in a court is only worth half of a man's. In other words, you need two women to equal one man in a court. According to what Josephus was saying and what was believed at the time, four women were not enough in a court to show you how low a woman's value was. Did Jesus exclude women from his ministry? Women are with him all the time. Mary Magdalene, Mary and Martha, you go through a long list of individuals. And so again, they were not seen as respectable, but instead Jesus elevates women. So that's the first point. The second one, though, I think it also shows the historical accuracy of the Bible. You know, if you were just write this story, you would not write the story where the first people to see Jesus would be what? Women. As a matter of fact, you know, Peter at once says, we were not following cleverly devised myths when we made known to you, because we were, he says, what? Eyewitnesses. So it shows that these were not cleverly devised myths, but instead, I think, is one more powerful, if you will, apologetic argument for the historical accuracy of that. No man, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Peter, Paul, no of them would probably in that culture have ever talked about women and certainly not have had them be the first eyewitnesses. I think it's pretty powerful. The fifth and final one, and that is, put this here for some of you that come from a Catholic background. They said, don't focus on the suffering of Jesus and neglect the glory of the cross. That is, some traditions in particular talk so much about the passion of Christ. Matter of fact, that's really what the movie was all about. Mel Gibson being Catholic, it's all about the passion. Well, the passion was important to lead to what? The resurrection. And I think John addresses that in John 13, which we looked at a couple of weeks ago. He said that Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world and loved them to the end. What we should see is certainly there was the passion, But the cross was not an end in itself. It was a means for our salvation. The cross was not a dead end. It was merely a station on the way back to the Father. And so as important as it is to recognize the suffering Jesus endured on the cross, it's more importantly to get the rest of the story. And the rest of the story is, as we see in Hebrews, that Jesus what? Endured the cross for what? For the joy set before him. And we today can certainly recognize that as well. The death of Jesus on the cross was our salvation. And next week, we no longer leave Jesus in the grave. We bring him out of the grave. Let me again encourage you to watch tonight, AD. You'll see a little bit more of what we've been talking about today. Parker?